Pushkin. Before we get started, let's talk about Pushnik. Pushnik is a subscription program available exclusively on Apple Podcast subscriptions. Members will get access to bonus content, like extended versions of our Beastie Boys and Brian Eno episodes. You'll also get ad-free listening to many of your favorite podcasts like Revisionist History, Cautionary Tales, The Happiness Lab, and ours, Broken Record. You can try it for free for 7 days. Sign up for Pushnik and Apple Podcast subscriptions. Rick Nielsen is best known as Cheap Trick's lead guitarist and main songwriter. The band that helped popularize power pop in the late 70s, with songs like Surrender and I Want You to Want Me. Precursors to the pop punk explosion in the 90s, with bands like Green Day and Blink 182. In June, Cheap Trick released their 20th studio album, In Another World. It's chock full of Rick Nielsen's monster riffs that recall their glory days in the 1970s. On today's episode, Bruce Headlam talks to Rick Nielsen about Cheap Trick's origin story, while Nielsen fiddles around on electric guitar and samples riffs from the new album. Nielsen also talks about how he was hired to bring a hard rock sound to John Lennon's final album with Yoko, Double Fantasy, and what it was like working with the Beatles' legendary producer, George Martin. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Bruce Headlam with Cheap Trick's Rick Nielsen.
We're going to talk about In Another World, which is your new album. It sounds like you guys were having fun making this album.
Well, I think we were, and I think we do.
Just sounds really kind of joyful and fun.
That's kind of the idea. I mean, we make records for ourselves. I mean, we don't have a manager that hangs over us or a producer that's, here's what we're going to do. We got this going. And the record label of BMG has been fabulous. I mean, they're so fabulous that that they don't bother us.
And it's like it's the perfect record label.
It's the first one we've ever had like that. It's pretty cool.
So what's writing like? Are you on a bus? Are you in a hotel and you just pick up your guitar?
It's kind of how we always did it. I mean, I used to write 100% of the stuff, or 90%. We just got, somebody's got an idea. And that sounds, if it sounds interesting, then we'll go for it.
Now, you just picked up a guitar, which is not a surprise, because you own, how many guitars now do you own?
About 500. Well, I've owned about 2,000 instruments. But I've been around for a long time. And I've traded stuff. I've had stuff. I broke stuff. I gave stuff away. I mean, I've got a guitar, a real guitar, in almost every hard rock around the world.
Yeah. So while you've got the guitar in your hand, tell me about writing the first single, which is Summer Looks Good on You.
I think we had the title first. Seemed like a good idea. Unless, you know, this could be a summer song, you know. So, here comes the summer. Yeah, that's that one.
That's it, yeah.
Because we had two that came out about the same time that we were doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. You know, it's like how we wrote the parts. We did the D part. The B flat sounds kind of weird in there, but
yeah,
that was some stuff that we like when we did Taxman. And Stiff Competition, same thing. You look high. I mean, I just kind of like that.
That sound, yeah.
Thing, and it sounds different every time. We use chords that a lot of people don't use. You know, it's like over and over again.
Yeah, well, and the song is in E, right, isn't it?
Well, the chorus is D. And the verse is A. There you go.
Listening to the, and I hadn't really thought of it before, it sounds a lot like Peter Townsend to me.
We hit the chords equally hard.
Was he an influence on you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Who was the best live band ever? I mean, you know, I played with them, opened for them when Keith Moon was still around.
And what was that like?
It was great. You know, it's like because we'd read about them, and actually we knew their songs. We opened for them at Majestic Hills in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin in 1968. 2 weeks after we'd opened for Frank Zappa and the Mother's Invention.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, you were the band when you came out that everybody liked. The heavy metal guys liked you. The new wave guys liked you.
What's not to like?
Well, what's not to like? But you just appealed to such a wide group of, like, everybody could agree on Cheap Trick, even though if they disagreed about everything else.
It seems like that. I mean, I heard that from a lot of people. I mean, you know, like the Ramones liked Cheap Trick, you know. And Joey did a number of our songs. He did Southern Girls. He came to see us. And he's like, you know, he's from New York. We're from the, you know, Chicago area. We never, you know, really saw them unless we went to see them. We didn't know them personally. So it was like when we start meeting these guys, it was kind of fun. And the New York Dolls, they came to see us play.
I want to go way back.
Okay.
Because you grew up in a musical family.
Yes, I did.
Tell me about that.
My father was an opera singer, and he was also a religious kind of singer. He sang with Billy Graham. He had a radio show in Chicago on WMBI, which is the Moody Bible Institute, where both my grandfathers graduated from. They were both ministers. So I was around music. My dad was a choir director in World War II. He's a captain. And he was served at the Aleutian Islands and in Roswell, New Mexico. But he was always around music. And my dad was choir director at a church in Rockford. But we went to Chicago to the Baptist churches. At those times, here's a white guy with a black woman. It's like, and they're singing this great music, and everybody's having fun. I said, this is it. Then I go back to the other stuff, and it's like, put you to sleep music for me. It's like, holy cow, what did I do wrong, God? You know, it's like, and then my father also did opera. He did Barbara Seville, which I walked on stage when I was 3 years old, supposedly. And I walked out on stage when they're doing Barbara Seville, and people started to laugh and clap. And I was like, this is what I like this. So I like it when people laugh and clap. And it wasn't a direct route to all this stuff. But so I was around these kind of wacky artists. So I worked in my dad's music store where I goofed off mostly. So I'd see everybody. You know, Sam Kinison actually rented a PA when he was an evangelist, he and his brother.
Oh, amazing. Was there a moment when sort of pop music came on the scene or rock music?
I started out playing drums. Let There Be Drums, I think, was one of them. It was Sandy Nelson. And I like Gene Krupa. I like that stuff. And plus, music on drums is sort of like mathematics, and I was always good at math. You know, like instead of one, two, three, four, drums, one E and a, two E and a, three E. I could write out music like that although I couldn't really read it, I knew how to write it out for me. And that really helped me later in songwriting. And then as it progressed, I started playing in bands as a drummer, and the guitar players were always, even if we would do a Rolling Stones song or something, I didn't know how to play guitar, but I knew they were playing the wrong note. So I'd get off the drums and I'd figure out what the part was. And after too much of that, I just decided to give up the drums and find some other kid that could count to four on drums. And I just taught myself how to play guitar.
Did you just get a guitar from your dad's shop?
I actually got a guitar from my mother. It was a Goya, a Swedish brand nylon string guitar. That was my first one. I still have it. It doesn't sound any good, and it's kind of smashed up and broken, but that's how I kind of learned. The neck was wider and stuff, so I actually learned how to play a more difficult instrument instead of this easy stuff that I got in here.
You're the sort of guitar hero to people, but you're not the kind of guy that stays up on stage and plays like 10-minute solos.
Oh, I hate that. That's why years ago I used to stack my guitars one on top of another. I mean, you know, I'm a songwriter and an entertainer. I'm not really a virtuoso at all. My solos are shortened to the point. The song is more important than me.
Right. And do you have all your solo parts and all your licks worked out before you go on stage?
Well, if I know the songs, you know, sort of.
Yeah. Like, you're not like Angus Young or someone who just gets up there and plays and plays.
Well, he plays a lot of the stuff that's, you know, that he's worked out, you know, the stuff that's on the record. So that, you know, I'll change it if it's that bad. But it's like, usually what I do is like, I'll play something that's realistic according to me. And it's like, I don't know how to explain it. It's like on this new record, it's like, I don't sound like I'm in this old guy. I sound like sometimes I would do a solo that's more like the MC5 or Neil Young. He plays one note. That's good enough.
Yeah, he plays it well.
Yeah.
When you started playing electric guitar and you were in bands, who were the guitarists who influenced you to get that very particular sound?
Well, my favorite, and I went to see him. I was, I think, the first show of, I'm not sure what year, 64, the Yardbirds. Jeff Beck, right from the start. And I thought he was great then. I think he's great now. He's still kind of my hero. And I sold him a guitar in 1968, the second Les Paul he ever owned.
Really?
Yeah. I went and saw him in Chicago at the Connecticut Playground.
What was it about his playing you liked so much?
You know, back then it was like the guitar players that you kind of knew about was Scotty Moore, Chet Atkins, but they played with round wound strings, and he was like, it just didn't sound right. Jeff Beck sounded like, how does you get that sound? It's like, I was, back then there was no guitar magazine kind of things. I read in Hit Parader, and it was like, how did Jeff Beck get that? He says, well, I just, you know, punched out the speaker, you know, made it kind of raspy and whatever. Of course, the first thing I did was go punch holes in my speakers, and that wasn't it. It's him. Yeah.
You need Jeff Beck to punch a hole in your speaker. Not anybody can do it.
Yeah, you got to have the right punch.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more from Rick Nielsen after a quick break. We're back with more of Bruce Headlam's conversation with Rick Nielsen.
You were playing in bands. The other guys in Cheap Trick were playing in bands. How did you finally all get together?
So I met Tom in high school, and I knew Bunny. Bunny was in an opposing band. He was in the Pagans, and I was in the Grim Reapers. And I was like, okay, so I thought they were wimpy, and he thought I was a Ballyhoonian.
What does that mean?
They carry knives. Like a hood.
Oh, okay.
I was a troublemaker. He had a single out, Good Day Sunshine, with the Beatles. Good Day Sunshine. You can imagine that's like, that's even wimpier than when I'm 64.
So then when did you meet Robin?
Robin, Bunny knew him, because Robin hit, you know, he's like 5 years younger. So I never knew him. But we had heard that the singer, it was called B.B. Kent or something. He was in a duo. He was doing Bee Gees songs and Neil Young and Beatles. We heard that this guy was really good. So I went up there with my manager at the time. It's like, because we were looking for a singer. No, he picked the other guy. But Robin, I could tell he'd been in choir and stuff growing up. And so he was a real singer, legit. Later, he actually took some singing lessons from my father.
Was that right?
Yeah.
Now, you guys, when you were playing, just because where you were near Chicago, you'd go to Wisconsin. You must have spent a lot of time in vans.
Oh, yeah. Did it like crazy.
Yeah. I read somewhere that you preferred playing suburban places because the crowds were bigger. Like if you went into Chicago, some of the clubs just weren't, they weren't big enough.
They weren't big enough. And it's like, for the most part, they liked their horn bands. And you know, it's like and going and play original stuff was not easy, you know, because you get the jobs, you know, what Rolling Stones song, what do you do from the top 40? We'd always say, well, you know, we got a whole bunch of stuff. And we never did. So we did get fired a couple places because we didn't do what they wanted.
Did playing like bigger halls out in the suburbs, did that affect your sound? Did that help shape how you came out?
You know, being a three-piece, you got to do what you do. I mean, when like that chord I played to that A chord, mm-hmm. if you let it ring out, there's certain ways to play. It's like I didn't go chick, 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 you know, like some guitar parts and stuff. I never played like that. It's like I played to fill the sound out. And so mm-hmm. we'd go to those places, and we always had built our own PA. So we'd go to these places like, so we knew what we wanted. We used to use a TX 3340 as the slap echo on the voice to sound like John Lennon.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's a reel-to-reel. We had to, you know, it was running all the time. But it's like, if I go back and listen to some of the tapes we did, we were playing in clubs and we sounded good.
Yeah.
And we had good amps. In 1968, when I bought my Mellotron at Orange Music, I bought it used. I also bought the very first Orange amp, which I still have today. I just liked it. And I was like, and I happened to be smart enough or lucky enough to surround myself with good equipment.
Yeah. So when did you get signed to do the first Cheap Trick album?
76. Jack Douglas came to see us. We got turned down by a bunch of people sending tapes out or whatever. And Jack Douglas had heard our stuff and liked it, but wanted to see us. So he came to Waukesha, Wisconsin, because his in-laws lived there. The Sunset Bowl, bowling alley, that had bands on the weekend or whatever. And we'd played there a number of times. And Jack came that night, and the place was packed, and everybody's drunk, and it's like, and then we came up and played, and he immediately liked us. I don't know who he talked to, Tom Werman or somebody at the record company, and says, you got to sign these guys. I said, I'll do them. You know, and here's Jack, who's done Aerosmith records. So, I mean, it's like, his name meant a bunch. So we actually went in not long after that, and went to New York, and went to the record plant, and did 20-some songs in 8 days or something like that.
By that point, had you guys kind of figured out your look? I think it was Jeff Tweedy who had a great line about like how you guys perfected the two good-looking guys, two weird-looking guys thing for a band.
I never wanted to be anybody else. I don't know that I wanted to be me, but I was always a class clown, and I was always the wise guy. And so, you know, I didn't look like a rock star. You know, like a lot of bands back then, they wore their mother's makeup and used their mother's hairspray. And it's like, that wasn't me. It was like, so I kind of perfected because, like, you know, I had fun being the goof off. You know, I'd play these guitar solos or whatever. And it's like, and people look at me, it's like, that's that guy? You know, he doesn't look like he has a nickel in his pocket. And,
mm-hmm. you know. Your first album, I don't think, sold, but your second album had, I Want You to Want Me? I think it did.
Yeah, that was In Color. And we did that. That came out in 77 also, between the first album coming out and that. And that came out, and it was the Rolling Stone issue where Elvis had died. He's on the cover, and our review's on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And we got, I think we got pretty good reviews. And that one sold a little bit more. But in Japan, we had a number one song with Clock Strikes 10, which never got any airplays.
And so it must have been strange, though, because you were a struggling band here. You put out some albums. You hadn't had a lot of success. But then you went to Japan. You did the live album, but you were like the Beatles in Japan.
That's what it seemed like, didn't it? It was frightening, but it was like they were the coolest people I'd ever met, you know, or never met. You know, it's like, these guys like us.
There was so much screaming at the concerts.
I know. And it was fantastic.
And then was it strange to come back to the States where you're...
Oh, yeah.
You were big in Japan. You weren't so big here yet.
Yeah. Well, I was like, man, you got a taste of that. Now, that's cool. You know, it's like, we can play these arenas and do okay. You know, because we were slaying them over there. And it was like, yeah, you know. But they liked us. I mean, we're a good band. I mean, we're not great or whatever. But
you're a very distinctive band. Because you've written most of the songs... Can you tell me, what is there some secret sauce to a Cheap Trick song? What is it that makes your songs distinctive, that people like about them?
I think we're diverse, which I think is probably, you know, it's like somebody might like this one, and then it's like, oh, but there's other stuff you can listen to. It's not like one song and then they're 90% more, but they're just not as good as that one. And, you know, different people like different stuff. I mean, Clock Strikes 10, it's like, that's a hit. It's like, here, if you'd play it, nobody knew it. And one of the things that we had done on our early records is like, I wrote Hello There for a sound check. Hello There, lady. You know, it starts out drums, boom, boom, boom. Okay, now that's in. Okay, now the bass, boom, 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 boom. And here's the guitar, mm-hmm. da-da-da. It was a sound check for doing these big shows we were doing. Because if you think about it, what intros, what's the first song we should play in our set with Queen or whoever? You got to get their attention. Let's play this one that's real moody and in the middle part, you know, it's like, don't overthink it. So that's how those songs came about.
We'll be right back with more from Rick Nielsen after a quick break. We're back with the rest of Bruce Headlam's conversation with Rick Nielsen.
You've had a long relationship with the Beatles. Now, I'm not quite sure. I know George Martin produced your album in 1980. And that's also when you were working with John Lennon. Which came first?
We worked with George in Air Studios in Montserrat, and it was the beginning of 1980. And then, mm-hmm. and then we went to England to finish it. And then it was in August of 80, August 12th, that I went and worked with John Lennon.
So tell me, what was it like to work with George Martin?
Well, George was great. He was like the smartest musician, producer, overall arranger, whatever. I mean, he liked us too. I mean, we were kind of shocked at that. You know, and we got him to come to Madison. He and Jeff Emmerich come to Madison in the middle of winter for pre-production. You can imagine hey, George Martin, you want to go to Madison, Wisconsin with 3 foot of snow and wear your galoshes now? And he came to see us and he liked the band enough and the songs enough and us enough that he said yes. And so, hey, we're going to go to Montserrat in the British West Indies, my new studio, Air Studios. Okay. You know, it's like, you know, so we packed up and went down there and did the tracks there and then finished it. Then we flew to New York and took the Concorde over to London. And we took the Concorde over and then we took it back when we were done. We went to stay in London and finished the record there.
But I'm fascinated just because there's so many stories about George Martin with the Beatles. What was he like in the studio?
Oh, it was great. He was like very professional and to experiment on stuff. We did Stop This Game was one of them. And he, the intro. So I did that, but we did it with the orchestra. Dot, 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 dot. But the very beginning of the song is like, well, I can't stop the music. I can stop it. We recorded an E note, and then he went to the second track on a piano and recorded that. And we left the attack off on each one. So you didn't hit the da, you hit the And then the next one, and we did like, I don't know how many, 12 tracks of that, you know, delaying the next one by a beat and then the next one. And so it's just a continuous loop. And it was like, and I think he said, well, that's what they use at the end of one of the Beatle tracks. So we were privy to that, you know, working with the best guy on earth in some of those tricks. And later when we did all the Sgt. Pepper shows, which I went to George's house out in the country, and he cooked lunch for us, and I got his blessing and the charts for Sgt. Pepper to do that.
Oh, he gave you the original charts?
Yeah.
You guys did a big performance of Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah, we did about 90 shows. And so I got his blessing for that. And, you know, we just got along well. It's like, and here I am, you know, I always think of myself, I'm Rick from Rockford, you know. It's like, you know, it's like, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anyways. I said, if you can make it in Rockford, you can make it anyways. You know? And so then when he passed away, I got an email from him and his family or whatever. It's like, we'd like invite to his memorial service. So I went, flew to England and went to this thing, and I guess it said family side on the back of my invitation. And so I sat there, I'm like, right up front, behind me is Elvis Costello. Here's Genesis back there. Here's Pink Floyd. All these, you know, all these famous people. And they're way, way behind me in this place. And as we file out to leave, I go and talk to Yoko, Sean, and Julian, because they were right ahead of me. And we talk for about a second. And then all of a sudden, somebody comes up to me. Hello, Rick. I said, hello, Paul. Paul came over, you know, Paul... The guitar he plays, I got for him too. Not that far, but yeah. Yeah, that's the left-handed Les Paul that he plays. So I had one. I was like, what am I doing with this thing? It's like it's a piece of art, but I can't play it. So I said, McCartney should have it, you know. And then I said that in a guitar magazine, and a few months later, then he ended up getting it.
Wow.
Yeah.
But later that year, after you recorded the album with George Martin, you worked on Double Fantasy with John Lennon. What was that like?
Oh, it's terrific. You know, it's like I treated it like guy to guy. I did, you know, musician to musician. You know, he's one of my favorites. You know, what can you say? Well, see, I was asked by Jack to do it, to rock up this stuff that John was doing. If you listen to the original Double Fantasy, it's like, it sounds like a lounge band to me. It's too produced. So Earl Slick learned my riffs and did them, but you know, it's like, it's not, you know, I like to do this. Or here in my changes room, nothing in afternoon. You know, it's like the way it is on the record is, you know, it's like it's, mm-hmm. My version was heavier, and then I came up with the riff. So when I was doing it, here's Bunny and Jack in the booth when I was playing the guitar. After we had done the initial track, John says, "God, I wish I would have had Rick on Cold Turkey." Clapton choked up, or Clapton froze. He could only play the one riff.
Wow, that's a high compliment. So how were they to work with? How were John and Yoko?
They were great. They were great. You know, it's like they were terrific. And the musician was like, it's just cool. And he was a great rhythm player too. And I'm a good rhythm player. And it's like together it just kind of worked out. And it's like we enjoyed each other's company. And I'd hope to take him out guitar shopping after the sessions. Not that day, but you know, I gave him one of my guitars. Because I said, we're going to Japan the next day and after the session, and I'll get it back later. And I got it back 3 years after he was murdered.
Yeah. Oh, that's very sad.
Yeah.
So into the 80s with Cheap Trick, and I still can't quite believe this, but you guys had this run of great hits and great albums. But then your record label decided that you had to, like, bring in professional writers.
Yeah. That beat up my ego pretty much. It was like, we weren't somebody else, and we don't try to make us into somebody else. And we didn't have a label or a producer or a management that stuck up for us. You know, we'd always done other people's material. Like we did the first album, did Terry Reed songs, and we did Roy Wood's songs. You know, Beatles, we did Beatles stuff too, you know, but that was our own picking. You know, it's like, and here we got, now we're doing something that's not written by us. So it's like, it just didn't make sense to me. It still doesn't, but there you go.
Did you have to co-write with them, or these were songs that were given to you?
I co-wrote some songs. I mean, I'm not opposed to that, but this was already signed, sealed, delivered.
Yeah.
Before we had The Flame, when that came out, we did a record with Todd Rundgren, Next Position Please, and on that, they had us doing a Motors song. Dance on the night away, bop, bop. Oh, Jesus.
So are you the kind of guy that just walks around with your iPhone, and if you get an idea, you just record it? So you've got these little snatches of ideas?
I got tons of bad ideas. But I've always kind of done that. I mean, I've written stuff down. It's like my one thing is like in the middle of the night, you wake up and you write something. Oh, man, this is something here. And then you wake up and it's chocolate milk. You know, what are they, huh? You know, it's like, how did that turn in? Why was that important enough to write it down? So there's usually something there. So, I mean, I've got tons of that kind of stuff. My wife says, the F word, finish. You know, finish it. We were writing songs. It's like a producer would come say something to me like, well, what's the third verse like? I said, well, do you like the first one before I, you know, spend the time to write the third one? You know, that goes into the arranging and all that stuff. Like in Surrender, starts off in B flat, and then the first verse and second verse, they're in B. Third verse is in C. It modulates up. That's an arrangement. You know, it's not really so much the song.
You love doing those kind of modulations in songs.
Yeah. It's cool. You know, it's better than going na 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 hey. You know, a lot of those songs, they're good songs, turn into junk when you have too much na na hey hey.
All right. It's been great talking to you.
Well, cool.
Great, great album. I hope everybody listens. It's just a lot of fun.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks to Rick Nielsen for running through some of the highlights of his career with us. To hear In Another World and our favorite Cheap Trick tracks, head to BrokenRecordPodcast.com, where we also have a playlist of some of our favorite power pop songs. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Martin Gonzalez, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez, with engineering help from Nick Chafee. Our executive producer is Mia LaBelle. If you love this show and others from Pushkin Industries, consider becoming a Pushnik. Pushnik is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushnik exclusively on Apple Podcast subscriptions. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. Our theme music by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.